sahanavavatu, sahanau bhunaktu, sahaviryam karavavahai, tejasvinavadhidhamastu, mavidvishavahai. Om shanti, shanti, shanti. Today, our subject for discussion is Swami Adbhudananda, a disciple of Sri Ramakrishna. Now, there is something very profound and significant about the name of this monk. Adbhudananda, Adbhuda actually means something that you cannot explain, miraculous, mysterious, so surprising that you cannot find a real explanation for it. That's what the particular word means, Adbhuta. Now, there is something very interesting about this saint. So normally when we talk about saints, spiritual teachers, we have in our mind the picture of a great philosopher, somebody who has studied a lot of ancient scriptures, well-versed in different philosophical systems, who has done a lot of spiritual practices, the great teacher. That's the normal image we have of a saint. Saint Augustine was himself a great scholar, and Saint Aquinas in Christian tradition. But there are also some strange figures in the glorious tradition of sainthood in both Eastern and Western traditions. Saint Joseph, known as Saint Luceppi, was born in Italy. He was well known for his lack of erudition, but he was not totally ignorant of scriptural knowledge. He knew something. He knew some little something about the Bible, but he was certainly not a great theologian. Because great saint, he was conferred sainthood in 1730, around that time. And we have the image of the pilgrim, in the Wafer Pilgrim, a well-known Christian mystical work in the Russian Orthodox tradition. So like that, we have a lot of saintly figures who are not necessarily scholars or philosophers, but we don't have anybody who is totally devoid of any kind of scriptural knowledge and who still lived the life of a great saint, and he was a repository of great scriptural wisdom. Such a saint was Swami Adbhudananda. He had a very humble background. He was born somewhere in Bihar. In fact, he himself did not actually reveal the date of his birth. He was so humble. He was born in a backward village in the Chapra district of Bihar, which at that time was very backward. But he became a saint. Now, I would just give an example of his profound scripture knowledge before explaining his lack of erudition, because that will give you a better clear picture of the whole thing. There was a very interesting incident in his life. He was living in Belumut, and great scholars and Sanskrit pandits used to visit the place and used to give lessons to the young novices in Sanskrit, Vedanta, different systems of Indian philosophy. So once it so happened that Swami Adbhudanandaji, though he could not read scriptures, happened to listen to the detailed exposition of an important verse in the Kathopanishad, which comes to the end of that text, which gives you a graphic description of the imminence of the all-pervading reality. So God as one divine reality is present everywhere and is also present in all of us. So the indweller aspect of the divine reality is called Antaryami, or the immanence, and the all-pervading aspect is called Sarvavyapi Tvam in Sanskrit, means all-pervading, omnipresent. This idea is very clearly expressed in this verse. So, once a great Swami in the Ramakrishna order, who was present at that time he was quite young, gives an interesting narration, description of Swami Adbhudanandaji's intuitive understanding of a profound scriptural statement. We will come to that later. How this happens, we'll try to explain. Swami Shuddhananda recalled an interesting event about this interesting saint. I remember an occasion when I slept in the same room with Swami Adbhudanandaji. His name was Latu Maharaj. He was very old. At that time he was very old. He would pass away very soon. So there some new novices used to give them medical help, give them treatment, because Swami Adbhudanandaji did not live long after this incident. So at midnight he got up and said, "Sudhir, read the Gita." So he asked his attendant, "Read the Bhagavad Gita." So I read the Gita to him that night. And he was completely absorbed while listening to this reading of Holy Scripture. On another occasion, Swami Adbhudananda went with Shuddhananda to listen to a class by a great Sanskrit scholar, Pandit Seshadhar, on the Katha Upanishad. So this is an interesting Vedantic text which has got this interesting, profound statement. So there's a verse, those of you are interested, you can read towards the end of the text. Angushtamatra purushontaratma sadan jananam kradaye sannivishtaha. So this Purusha means Purishetedi Purushaha. The divine reality, God, as an indweller within our heart, as the immanent reality that guides, that regulates our actions. When that divine reality is present in all of us, we are able to think with our mind, we are able to cognize with our intellect, we are able to function with our senses of action and senses of perception. Because this divine spirit reality is present within us. Sada jananam skhrdaye sannivishtaha. It is the indweller present as the immanent reality within all of us. Tam swar sharira pravurhe munja diva ishigam dhairena tam vidya chukram amrudam. Tam vidya chukram amrudam iti. This is the verse. The meaning is simple. This divine reality, which is an immanent reality, is metaphorically said to be no longer than the thumb, as the inner self, divine, real, truth, God in his attributeless, formless dimension, as Atman. It is present as the inner self, always dwells in the hearts of all of us. Let a spiritual seeker separate him, the reality, from the body with perseverance, as one separates the tender stalk from a blade of grass. This is a metaphor and a kind of imagery that is used in this particular verse. So, you know, when the tender stalk can be easily removed from the blade of grass, when the grass becomes somewhat dry, then it's easy to separate it. Like that, when we try to discover the divine reality behind our mind, the divine reality that operates, that functions through our mind, but different from the mind, that divine spark within all of us, that activates the senses, that gives the ability to them for the mind to think and the intellect to cognize, that is our true identity. Our mind, intellect, senses, our desires, activities, all these are actually different and distinct from our true spiritual identity. Our true spiritual identity is this immanent divine truth. So how do you separate the divine truth from the outer shell? We do that through 7 disciplines. One is a strong sense of the real and unreal. And when we realize that the absolute reality is different from the relative empirical things, then we develop a sense of renunciation, detachment towards things which are only relatively real, worldly pleasures, senses, sensory pleasures, things like that. And then when we develop mental restraint, self-restraint, sense control, and so on, and also when we develop a strong desire, a sublime desire to grow in spiritual life for getting liberation. So these are 4 disciplines plus 3 more disciplines to reinforce these disciplines. We should keep reading scriptures, holy words that remind us of our true spiritual identity. And then we should be able to think deeply on the meaning of these great scriptural statements and meditate on them. So, sadhana chatushtaya, and sadhana chatushtaya includes 4 disciplines, which I already explained, and sravana, manana, nididhyasana, reading scriptures, concentration and meditation. Through these processes, disciplines, we'll be able to discover our spiritual identity behind our empirical, unreal identities. When we identify ourselves with the place where we are born, and no more than that, if our only identity is our physical body, which happens to be born somewhere, in some culture, speaking some language, eating some kind of food, following some kind of socio-anthropological customs and habits, when we limit ourselves to that physical identity, we get enslaved, spiritual slavery. When we dissociate ourselves, when we non-identify ourselves, when we distance ourselves from these empirical identities, then we realize our spiritual identity. We are one with the all-pervading divine reality. So this kind of rediscovery is what is meant by the statement that is separating the tender stalk from the blade of grass. Okay, now this much. So Shankaracharya gives a very profound, celebrated exposition of this statement. Now the Pandit went on explaining, giving a long exposition of this great spiritual truth. Very often, you know, a great scripture becomes great because it contains not only a profound philosophy, and when that philosophy also becomes a fact of our spiritual life. That's a major problem with modern philosophical systems. No criticism meant here. You know, so great thinkers have made this distinction. Philosophy, as it was with Plato, was a quest for truth not finding out the truth by debates, but finding out the truth by discovering it for ourselves. In Vedanta, it goes even beyond Plato. It says, philosophy is called darshanam. Darshanam has many meanings, but the most simple meaning is experiencing, getting a vision of, seeing. That's the real meaning of darshanam. Realizing for a fact in our own life. So, when Swami Adbhutananda, who was not a philosopher, who certainly have not read the scripture, may not even have heard of this. When he heard this, Sudhir, the Pandit, said it right. So, it's something like saying, you know, if you are familiar with the city of San Francisco, very familiar, and you talk to another gentleman who's equally familiar, when you explain one building or one street, he will say, oh yes, that's Simon's, I remember. But that person should have seen the city as you have seen. But in this case, the saint, Swami Adbhutananda, who is now subject of discussion right now, he has not even heard of this statement. He had not read it. Of course, he could not read. He could not read even his own mother tongue. Sri Ramakrishna was his guru. The only asset he had was the simplicity, a rustic simplicity. And that's a great fact, you know, great thing. Very often, we know, when we study, when we educate, it sometimes can be a problem for a spiritual seeker. We have to unlearn what you already learned, and you have to relearn. Vivekananda made it simple. If it is ever possible for me, I would like to forget all that I have learned. I mean, unlearning what we really learned. So when we read San Francisco Chronicle every day, when our mind is full of all these great, wonderful things that you read in newspapers, maybe not very wonderful for everyone, but then when we watch the stock markets, international conditions, political situations all over the world, and also Vedanta. So very often things get mixed up. Of course, great thinkers like Shankaracharya has given a solution to this problem. You may have to live in the world, walk and work in the Wall Street, and still you can be a saint. How? All those things, the figures appearing the computer screen or any other things, these things come and go. Agama payano anitya. That's what we read in the Gita in the last class. They come and they go. So once we realize the impermanent nature of something, then it's no more a problem for you. But that requires a process of relearning, you know. So learning, then unlearning, then relearning, re-education. But in the case of Swami Adbhutananda, he did not have to go through this process of unlearning and relearning. In his case, he was a simple person, rustic simplicity. When mind goes straight to the fact. So if you read the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, you find among the visitors who came to see him, there were great thinkers, there were great men. Vivekananda himself was an example. He was familiar with European history, European thought, Western philosophy, Sanskrit, and many things. He had already read the Origin of Species. He was going to Scottish Church College with a copy of Origin of Species. And actually the historians of Swami Vivekananda and historians of the late 19th century used to mention that students going to Presidency College, Scottish Church College, in the later decades of 19th century, used to hold in their hands a copy of the Origin of Species, and some of them, before Bolshevik Revolution, also a copy of Das Kapital and Communist Manifesto. That's long before the terrible things happened in Russia, because these systems were considered to be socio-economic political systems with no political implication. So you find Vivekananda making a statement which may not impress you right now after 1917. The point is, I'm a socialist, not because it's a perfect system, But because half a loaf is better than no bread. This was a statement that comes from Vivekananda. And that was long before the revolutions in Russia, China and so on. So what I mean to say, that was the age when great thinkers, students studying in Presidency College, Scottish Church College, were visiting Vivekananda and, sorry, Sri Ramakrishna. And Sri Ramakrishna, with a sense of humor, used to make them argue among themselves. And he used to encourage a kind of lively debate between a kind of bohemian like Girishchandra Ghosh, who was an intellectual, and a bohemian, and Vivekananda, who was a great intellectual scholar. And he used to enjoy these two young fellows fighting, you know, talking about philosophy and so on. So among them there was this man, this Adbhutananda, who had, was practically almost illiterate. Maybe he was really illiterate. I think the whole history of great saints, his distinction is he was the only one who was totally illiterate in that respect. And he listened to one of the most profound statements from Vedanta and he says, yeah, that's a fact. Just as I mentioned earlier, you know, if you meet a friend who also staying in San Francisco, and you say, you talk about one building, an office or a street. Yes, I know that building. I have walked in front of that building. Like there, the saint tells the pandit or another Swami, yes, that's a fact. So where did he get this direct intuitive knowledge of an abstract spiritual statement? How does human mind develop this unique skill to understand, or rather it is not mind understanding something, your system, your intellectual system, mental system, without the aid of any books or any instruments, immediately captures kind of direct perception, a great profound spiritual truth. So that's the subject of discussion right now. So that's why Swami Vivekananda is well known for making a very interesting statement about this Swami. Swami Adbhutananda, Lord to Maharaj, is the greatest miracle of Sri Ramakrishna. Having absolutely no education, is attained to the highest wisdom simply by the touch of the master. So he had only one asset, that is total dedication, total surrender. What do you call in Sanskrit? Prapatti. And all other qualities that come along with that, humility, simplicity. It is not assumed humility. So that's why frequently humility is not a very pleasant word in many contexts. See, the story goes, you know, a small little child was given an award, the humblest child in the school award. So next day, and he was given a certificate. Next day he came to the school hanging the certificate on his neck, announcing that. So the certificate was taken away from him. So real humility is not the humility that you parade, that you demonstrate, that you substantiate, that you demonstrate in the presence of others. The real humility is actually simplicity. That's a better word. That's what Gita tells you. So when you become humble in that sense, it's like a vessel that is empty. You know, if you have got a jar or a vessel, which if there are a few drops still left, then whatever you pour into that, it be mixed with whatever is there already. But when the vessel is empty, then there's a possibility that it could become completely filled. If it is half empty, in the sense, when we have our own ideas, our own prejudices, our own mental blocks which prevent our own spiritual growth, then God's grace doesn't always function. It may function only in part. So the vessel is empty, then it can be completely filled. When it is half empty, in the sense when it is already full of our own ideas, prejudices, then God's grace may not always function. That seems to be the mystery behind these great saints who did not have any of their own ideas, their own prejudices, their own inherited or acquired characteristics which they carried with them. They didn't have any of them. So God's grace was like filling an empty vessel, so it gets completely filled. So, and that also gives you a kind of unique wisdom, which again I would say it's kind of spiritual common sense. Common sense that we acquire by experience, by maturity, by education is one thing. It could be lopsided frequently because it analyzes and understands things with the help of some tools. Rational thinking, analysis. We try to judge and understand things with the help of whatever tools we have, our intelligence, our way of understanding, analysis, and so on. But the spiritual common sense, which comes to a person as a result of the spiritual practices, is kind of intuitive wisdom that goes straight to the truth without the instrument of analysis, comparison, or prejudices, or our own ideas which we taken for granted, which we normally take for granted. So that intuition is perhaps the real explanation for the spiritual common sense. So you develop a unique intuition and a particular kind of common sense. So that's why Swami Turiyananda, who incidentally was the great saint who came to this Northern California for the first time after Vivekananda. Vivekananda deputed him to start Vedanta work in this part of the United States. And he started an ashrama in Shanti Ashrama. And every year, on the last Saturday of April, we hold a one-day retreat. Devotees come from all over the country and outside sometimes. So that Swami, and he was well known as a very ascetic, orthodox, traditional Vedantic scholar. He has translated many of Shankaracharya's books like Viveka Chudamani. And he was well known for his profound scriptural knowledge. That Swami Turiyananda writes about Adbhutananda. Many of us had to go through the muddy waters of intellectual knowledge before we attained God. I mentioned, you know, education, then what you call de-education, or you may call learning, unlearning, and then relearning. That's why he says, Swami Turiyananda, many of us had to go through the muddy waters of intellectual knowledge before we attained God. But Lattu Maharaj, means Swami Adbhutananda, his name was Lattu, jumped over them all like Hanuman. Hanuman is a mythical figure in Hindu mythology, in the Ramayana, who jumped over huge ocean, you know. So anyway, that's a mythological illustration. And means Lattu Maharaj, this Swami, could jump over all these muddy waters of scriptural knowledge. That's why Vedanta tells you something very interesting. You do not need scriptural knowledge or formal education or philosophical understanding to become spiritually enlightened. For spiritual enlightenment, you don't need this. But if you want to teach others, you need them. So you find in Hindu Vedantic tradition two types of teachers. One kind of teacher, acharyas, avataras, incarnations. And another kind of teacher, great saints, some of them going through formal education, some of them without any formal education. But the difference is, those who are epoch makers have to study all the even empirical branches of knowledge. Why? Because they have to live in the world, work in the world, interact with people who misunderstand intellectual knowledge as spirituality. So they have to interact with them in their own language. So you find in many people are under the very wrong notion that Sri Ramakrishna was illiterate. That is absolutely wrong. Sri Ramakrishna was not reading books all the time, but he was not illiterate. He was perfectly literate. He could read and he could write. But a much more important thing is, Sri Ramakrishna never forgot what he learned, what he once heard. So in the life of Sri Ramakrishna, you find, right from the day he settled in Dakshineswar till his passing away, great scholars, some of the greatest scholars of those days, used to visit Dakshineswar from all over India, and they used to hold discussions and debates on Vedanta subjects, and Sri Ramakrishna used to listen to them. And he never forgot. Now many of us listen to a lot of wonderful ideas, and we read a lot. We don't remember them. That's a reality. But suppose you had the ability to perfectly remember every great philosophical statement you ever read or heard, you would be a great scholar. In the case of Sri Ramakrishna, he had a natural mental filtering mechanism which filtered out all unnecessary junk and adopted and accepted, imbibed all the precious gems. So that unique filtering mechanism he had. So in reality, according to our Hindu Vedantic tradition, forgetfulness is a great blessing from God. Matta smrdityanam apohanam cha. In the 15th chapter of Gita, Lord Krishna says, memory, knowledge, and the ability to forget. These are three gifts from God. Matta smrdi, smrdi, jnanam, apohanam. Apohanam means forget. See, you can imagine if you remember all that you have heard or had become familiar with, life will be totally miserable. Life will be equally miserable if you forget everything. So, but great saints, what happens for great saints, their mental mechanism is so tuned, so evolved, that they develop a unique mechanism to absorb what is precious, what is relevant, and filter out what is irrelevant. This all the great saints had, like Sri Ramakrishna. But Swami Adbhutananda did not have to go through this problem. So Swami Turiyananda says, he didn't have to go through this process of unlearning. But we actually do that when you turn to spiritual life. You unlearn many things. Or you at least try to unlearn many things. Whatever we consider to be very significant till now, and we suddenly realize their total insignificance, absolute hollowness. And immediately, the moment we realize their irrelevance, their insignificance, from that moment, those things are no more important for us, and so we automatically start filtering them out. This faculty is natural and spontaneous for great spiritual seekers. And this becomes easy when you are totally simple, total and utter simplicity and total freedom from doubts and skepticism, which again is the curse of modern education. Doubts and skepticism. The greatest example again is Vivekananda. Swami Vivekananda had many doubts when he first Sri Ramakrishna. But Sri Ramakrishna had no doubt about Vivekananda. See the contrast. Vivekananda doubted Sri Ramakrishna. He tested him. He was very skeptical. And you know, he was sent to Sri Ramakrishna not by a saint. He was sent to Sri Ramakrishna by a professor. I think he was a Scottish professor who was teaching. He was employed by the Church of Scotland in the Scottish Church College in Calcutta. And he was a professor of English. And he was teaching William Wordsworth's well-known poem is called Excursion, where he had to explain a word or trance which he could not really explain. And so he sent this young agnostic, intellectually vigorous young student, Vivekananda, to Sri Ramakrishna. You go and meet him, you will understand what trance really means. So Swami Vivekananda had a lot of doubts and skepticism. But Swami Adbhudananda had none of this. We have to remember, Vivekananda had to go through that stage in his spiritual evolution, because he had to come to America and Europe and all over India, of course, and deal with people who were full of doubts and skepticism. So he had to be trained in confronting the problem of skepticism. That's what you find. Even in India, when he was traveling in India, many people questioned him, many of them very arrogantly questioned him, doubted him, challenged him. All over India, Europe and America, he had to face people with skepticism and doubt. So he had to be trained to confront them using their own tools. But in the case of Swami Adbhudananda, total freedom from doubt and skepticism. I mean, total surrender to his teacher. And that's possible when your humility is not assumed humility. That the real psychological background of that humility is total transparency of human mind. So that enabled him to surrender himself completely to Sri Ramakrishna. Now what happens when you surrender to the will of God or a great spiritual person? That's what you have to remember, you know. This man, who had not learned, he completely believed in whatever his master told him, Sri Ramakrishna. So when he completely believed without any doubt, what happens is, his mind constantly thinks about his great teacher. So when you surrender yourself to a great spiritual teacher, actually your mind becomes an instrument in the hands of the spiritual teacher. Your mind becomes much greater than your own mind. So that's why when he was always thinking about, concentrating and focusing on Sri Ramakrishna and his spirituality, his mind gets colored. It completely reflects the spiritual wisdom of the master to whom he has surrendered his own mind. That's what happens. When you write with a pencil and the pencil goes for declaration of independence, you won't be able to write what you want to write. The pencil has to surrender itself to you, to the will of the person who is using that pencil for writing. So when a great, sincere, simple-hearted spiritual seeker surrenders himself or herself completely to the will of another great incarnation or great spiritual teacher, the great spiritual teacher's mind begins to work through his mind. His mind becomes just a reflecting medium. So then what happens? He developed this unique spiritual intuition. That must have happened to great men in other traditions also. The two examples that come to my mind from Christian tradition, one is Saint Joseph, the other one is the pilgrim in the way of a pilgrim. The pilgrim was not illiterate, as just like Adbhudananda. He was not illiterate. He could read and write. His autobiographical writings have become popular. That's what he called the way of a pilgrim, and the pilgrim continues his journey, two books. But Swami Adbhudananda's experiences go even beyond that, because he had no knowledge of writing. or reading. And not, he may have read somebody, sorry, no knowledge of reading or writing. He may have listened to people who are reading scriptures. But when he listened immediately, he felt as if he was listening to something that he already knew in his heart. So, Latu Maharaj himself says, don't think that once a spiritual aspirant has experienced samadhi, he can have it thereafter any number of times or whenever he wants. The master has given me endless grace. After making me struggle for only 8 years, he graciously lifted me up to that state again. One day I was seated on the bank of river Ganga when I saw a light coming out of the waters of the river. It grew in size until at last it filled the sky, the earth, and the space between them. Inside that infinite effulgence, there were numberless other lights. So he's explaining his experience. So that happens when a person empties his own mind. So that mind is filled completely, the brain, by God. If you don't empty, then if you empty your mind only 25%, then you get only 25% of the grace, because there is no inner space in the mind. The glass should be empty. Then only it can be refilled again with the spiritual wisdom. Now, again, there is another aspect to him. You know, he was employed by a senior devotee of Sri Ramakrishna. And then he came to Sri Ramakrishna, and Sri Ramakrishna accepted him, Sri Ramakrishna's disciple, another householder disciple who employed him, didn't mind it because he was also a great man. So the only thing that Latu, that was the name of Swami Adbhutananda, the only thing that he concentrated on was to do service to his teacher. And that too with great dedication and service. So when you do service without expecting any result, what happens? Our mind begins to move. When we go on doing things with a full expectation and worrying about the result, often obsessed with the outcome of what we are doing, our mind remains where it is, and frequently it goes down, it degenerates. But when we do, whatever we do, without a selfish thought behind, then what happens is, our mind begins to evolve. That's why you find people who constantly do service, any service of humility. You find, you can get many people working in San Francisco, but under society you find. After a few months sometime, a few weeks, they become totally different persons. Because they feel somehow something is happening to them. And they are not doing for the satisfaction of anybody, unselfish work. I can give the example of this from another organization which is not here. See, in India there is an organization called Vivekananda Kendra. It was founded by Ranade, Eganaji Ranade. He was a great follower of Vivekananda. Now he started this organization. His headquarters in Kanyakumari, which was, you know, there is a rock memorial. And one of their major functions was to spread education among the backward regions of Northeast, because educationally, socially, very backward, hygiene, medicine, and so on. So spreading education, hygiene, literacy, spreading literacy, that's the major work they took. So they normally invite graduates and postgraduates for doing unselfish work for 3 years minimum. They give training, then for three, four years, they give training, and then with a minimum salary, without expecting anything. Now, many of them eventually become monks. Now, you can imagine, they could easily get very good jobs, but they give up that aspiration and join this organization and work in very remote, backward places, spreading education, medical care, and so on. And you find gradually they evolve in spiritual life. You find even this case, you find among Christian missionaries. Christian missionaries, they may have the purpose of converting people, but there are still exceptional people, even among them. They're not totally unselfish because they want to tell you your religion is wrong, so you come over to my religion. You are worshipping the devil, so you can worship God if you come to my religion. That's what they are telling. So there is nothing very profoundly spiritual about it. But even among them, there are wonderful examples of total dedication to their chosen path. Total unselfishness. You find many of the Helen Keller, you can many. Florence Nightingale, you can find many such examples. This is a natural human psychological evolution. Unselfishness, total dedication, and doing something without any selfish motive will slowly help you to evolve to a higher level of spirituality. You call it spirituality, many of the men don't call it spirituality, but that's the only word we can use really. You become more unselfish, more noble, more compassionate. Now, that's what happened to him. So in Vedanta, you call it karma nishthayaha chitta suddhi dwarena pushartha hetutvam na swadantriyana jnana nishthadu swadantriyana pushartha hetuhu anyan apeksha. This statement in Shankaracharya's Bhashya, he says, unselfish action refines and purifies your mind, and that purified mind becomes a receptacle for the highest spiritual wisdom. That's Shankaracharya's statement. This is what happened to a person like Swami Adbhudananda. Without any education, without any formal training, just doing service without any expectation made him a great mystic. And what kind of mystic he was, that's what we are going to read now. These mystics, when he reached this level of mystical experience, they identify or they feel, they experience a kind of unity and oneness and identification with whole nature. They become totally informal. So, and sometimes, they live in the company of oceans, rivers, waters, mountains and forests. Animals also become their friends. They become the friends of animals, oceans, forests, trees and so on. So there is an interesting story about this Swamiji. A true mystic loves to live alone without any possessions and without depending on anyone except God. That's why between 1893 and 1894, Latu Maharaj, Swami Adbhudananda, left the monastery and began to live on the bank of the river Ganga. Vivekananda had already given shape to this great monastic tradition, following the teachings of Sri Ramakrishna. And many of Vivekananda's brother disciples, or all disciples of Sri Ramakrishna, began running this monastery, training novices, giving them training, education and so on. But this Swami was very informal. So that's what is mentioned here. So Latu Maharaj, he left the monastery. There are interesting incidents about this. One, Vivekananda, following the tradition of monasteries in the East and West, he had established some rules and regulations. When you give the bell in the morning, you should get up and meditate, and there should be proper timing and bell for lunch, supper, and all those disciplines which are necessary for any monastery to run. So Vivekananda had to do this. He was wandering all over India as a wanderer. But when he had to start a monastic organization, and he had to give rules and regulations for them. That's the only way to run a monastery. But Swami Adbhudananda was so informal. So one day he was able to leave the monastery. They told him, I can't say that when you give the milk, I should come and meditate. Meditation is not something that you go and immediately start. It is a mood that comes to you automatically. That is true, really speaking. But that won't work for the beginners. For beginners, you need a discipline. You go to kindergarten, you have to go through the grueling discipline, learning alphabets like that. So spiritual life also, at the beginning can be many years, one whole lifetime for many people. Beginning can be a very short period for advanced souls. So you have to begin somewhere, and you need disciplines, a particular infrastructure, time and punctuality and so on. So Latu Maharaj was so much a child of nature. So genuine, so informal, so simple. So he said, well, I can't say when you give the bell to meditate. Since then Vivekananda told him, okay, no, it's not for you, for it's yogi. It's meant for those who are joining at that time. They had to be given rules and regulations for their growth. So Swami Adbhudananda, Latu Maharaj, used to tie some dry gram, that is chickpeas, in the corner of his towel and leave it to soak in the Ganga river. He would eat it after it had softened. One day, as usual, he put this chickpeas to soak with a brick on the top of it to hold it in place in the river Ganga. You know, not a very clean place where you would like to leave your food to get soaked. But he was so much a part of nature, like river, so he didn't feel any distance, any remoteness. So it was ebb tide at that time. He sat for meditation, and he became so absorbed in meditation that he did not notice when the tide had changed. In the Ganga river Ganges, the tide changes every 6 hours. When he returned to normal consciousness, he found the river at full flood. And his gram, chickpeas, there was no way of knowing whether the cloth had been swept away or not. He sat still. What could he do? That was the only food he was eating, soaked, softened gram. When the tide had gone out again, he found his piece of cloth with the gram exactly where he had placed it. He picked it up and started eating. So that's one unique aspect of saints of this type. So Vedanta scriptures tell you, these saints, they walk as part of nature. In the Sri Ramakrishna's gospel itself, there are some interesting examples. A saint came to the Akshineswar temple. He took a bath in the Ganga. Not a bath, he just plunged into the waters, came out, and he stood in front of the temple and he chanted some Sanskrit hymns, and the whole temple shook because he could identify himself, the divine truth, the divine mother installed in the temple. So the total identification that comes automatically to saints like this. They are always living in that highest consciousness. Great teachers like Sri Ramakrishna or Shankaracharya or Buddha, or Christ also, you know, after 41 years, 41 days, he came back and started teaching. You find there is an ascent, there is a highest spiritual experience. Then there is a descent to a lower level to teach the world, to help the world, to give the message to the world. Then they go back. So this is a natural process for all the great epoch makers. In Vedantic tradition, we call them incarnations, like Krishna, Rama, Acharyas, Lord Shankaracharya, and so on. Sri Ramakrishna belonged to that tradition of incarnations. So you find he reached the highest samadhi, then he remained there, but he came back at will. It's called, you know, at threshold. You can enter at your will, and he taught the world and went back. They had a mission for the world. But there are other saints like this, You know, once they reach this experience, they become completely oblivious, forgetful of their body consciousness. They always remain and live in a transcendental plane. So there are examples in this Sri Ramakrishna's gospel. So this saint came, he plunged himself in the Ganga, came and stood in front of the temple and chanted the Sanskrit hymns, which was so terrifyingly, illustrative of our identity with the all-pervading divine reality. Another occasion, another person came, he plunged in the Ganga. Then what he did, you know, he sat there, dogs and animals, cows were eating food. He sat there and started eating. If you go there, the dogs may bark, the cows may try to drive you away. So when they see these human beings who have transcended their human dimension, who have identified with the all-pervading divine reality, which is present not only in us, but also in the whole creation. Because even in an ant or insect or an animal, this divine reality is there. So when you experience that, when you interact with them, that they instinctively understand it, but the greatest example is in the Yoga Sutra, Himsa Pradishthaya Tasannidhu Vairatyaga. There is a sutra in the Patanjali Yoga Sutras. Ahimsa Pradishthaya, when you get established in words, deed and thought, in total non-violence, that means we should be totally free from any kind of violent thought, violent impulse, violent ideas, violent words. When we reach that level of non-violence, then before that person, all people give up their own violence. But it may come back to them, but in their presence, that their presence has a pervasive effect on all those around them. So when such great men or women reach that highest mystical experience, they transmit this air of purity and spirituality around them. So that's what happened to this Swami. But he was simple, he was soft-hearted, he had a stern, rigid exterior in his spiritual practices. You know, Sri Ramakrishna told him, how long could you sleep? You should not sleep so long. Then he gave up sleep altogether. He used to sleep a little during daytime. Night he did not sleep. Because once he overslept, so Sri Ramakrishna corrected, if you sleep like this, when are you going to meditate? When are you going to realize God? So he gave up sleeping at night altogether. Whenever he felt sleepy, he used to walk. So that kind of rigid, stern attitude towards one's own discipline, spiritual discipline, and a soft, compassionate attitude towards others. Frequently, you know, we are very compassionate towards ourselves and very stern and rigid towards others. But a spiritual person becomes stern and rigid, uncompromising towards himself or herself, and compassionate towards others. Not in a human, most of the people become compassionate towards themselves and no compassion towards others. It is the other way around for spiritual seekers. So you find an example here. Once a man, fully drunk, came to him at midnight with some articles of food and requested Swami Adbhudananda that he must accept them. For after that, he himself could partake of them as sacramental food. Very often you find, that may not be spiritual mood, I have seen one person, he used to recite Vishnu Sahasranama when he was fully drunk. Other times he will be very jolly moving about. So you find there are some drunkards, they become extremely polite and humble when they are under influence of drinks. Other times they are quite rough. So maybe such a person suddenly, when he was fully drunk, he got, this man is a saintly man, so I must go and I offer some food to him. Then after he has taken, I should eat so that I will be purified. Such a, you may call it a crazy idea, but anyway, it came to this person who was so fully drunk. And Lattu Maharaj did not have any problem. He was very compassionate, very understanding, very considerate towards him. So a stern ascetic like Swami Adbhudananda quietly submitted to the importunities of this vicious character. And the man went away satisfied, all the way singing merry songs. When somebody asked him how he could stand the situation, Lattu Maharaj said, they want a little sympathy. Why should one grudge that? So in the midst of all this stern asceticism, a soft, compassionate attitude towards people who are less fortunate, and that may eventually help that man, you see, because the grace of or association of a saintly person will certainly have a mind influence on him. So this rustic simplicity and pure mind, total freedom from skepticism and doubt, and natural spontaneous attitude, all these make a person saintly, even if he is totally devoid of any formal education or scriptural learning. Swami Adbhudanandaji heard from Holy Mother about Vivekananda's success in the Parliament of Religions in Chicago. So Lattu often come to my place and listen eagerly to every word about Swamiji's triumphant activities in America. Swami Adbhudanandaji was very much very happy when he heard that Vivekananda had a great he was accepted. Appreciation in the West when he preached Vedanta here. It is bound to be so. Didn't the master say that in him 18 powers of working were working in the highest form? So Lattu Maharaj said, it's natural because in Vivekananda you can see these great spiritual powers were already understood by Sri Ramakrishna. There is one interesting incident that also gives a glimpse of Swami Adbhudananda's unique vision. Swami Vivekananda, in a lighter vein, told him, you know, all these things are happening. In course of time, what I have done now will gradually increase and influence larger number of people towards Vedanta. And then Lattu Maharaj said, what you have, you are doing the same thing. You are following the same lines, footsteps of great teachers of older times like Buddha, Shankaracharya and so on. The Vivekananda immediately, yes, that's true. And he appreciated Swami's intuition, Swami Adbhudananda's intuition. So what I mean to say, a spiritual progress, spiritual practices give us a unique kind of maturity of vision, outlook. And what again I would repeat, the unique spiritual common sense. Normal common sense very often is a result of biological maturity. You, when you become old with a lot of experiences, you think, you judge things in the light of your own experiences in the past. So you are able to judge things. But the spiritual common sense gives you an intuitive faculty to understand the true real nature of things. That's what you find in the life of this great saint, Swami Adbhudananda, in his complete, total and purest aspect you find in Swamiji. So thank you. I have tried to give just a bird view of the character and the picture of this great Swami. That's all. Thank you. Namaskar. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.